This is Henry Banks, host of People of Color on Wisconsin Public Radio. On the show today, my guest Jarrell Benton is the Director of Diversity and Inclusion at the University of Wisconsin in Superior, and he also serves as the Affirmative Action Officer for the UWS campus community. Jarrell is married and the father of two daughters. He joins us from Moorhead, Kentucky, as the new Diversity and Inclusion Director at the University of Wisconsin in Superior. He's going to sit down with me today to talk about his role on the university campus and in the city of Superior. Join me and my guest, Jarrell Benton, on People of Color after this news. Welcome to People of Color on Wisconsin Public Radio. This is Henry Banks. Thanks for joining us tonight. I am so honored to have in the studio tonight Jarrell Benton. He is the new Director of Diversity and Inclusion on the University of Wisconsin in Superior. He has been in this role, I believe, for about 4 months and new to the northern part of Wisconsin. And Jarrell, thank you for taking the time to come and talk to us today.
Yeah, no problem.
So, as I said, you've been here for 4 months.
6 weeks.
6 weeks?
Yes.
Wow, I was giving you 4 months. I don't know.
I feel like it's 4 months.
It doesn't really. Yeah. So Jarrell's only been here for 6 weeks. Wow, that's impressive. So you came here in the winter time.
Yes.
And you haven't really experienced a real winter, because we've had a mild winter. Are you happy with the mild winter?
I like to think that I brought the warm weather with me. So it is my first winter up north. I'm originally from Kentucky, so they've actually had an abnormal winter as well. It's been like 60s and 70s for the last few weeks. So
wow. So you're from Kentucky, and you came to northern Wisconsin.
Yes.
But you did that in the wintertime. That's a very bold.
No.
I'm impressed that you're able to do that because, you know, I was looking for a harsher winter this year. I was looking for a blizzard or so. And I know prior to us going on the air, I was talking about how we needed that blizzard. You need that experience, man.
No, I'm good without the experience. I like to think that I've had some winter experience before, but probably never encountered anything like what it is here. So
wow. So you are the Diversity and Inclusion Director here at UWS. So what brought you to our area? What was it that encouraged you to come here to be about making change, helping to build this university up for all people?
So yeah, so let me start by just giving a little bit of background, because I think it will help make some sense of kind of why I wanted this challenge. So before coming up north, I worked at Moorhead State University in Moorhead, Kentucky, as the Minority Retention Coordinator, where I was responsible for retaining ultimately the ethnic underrepresented groups on campus. So, and I just fell in love. That became my passion in the area of diversity work. And at that institution, I had the opportunity to do some cool things that were not a part of my job. They kind of even further, solidified my passion for wanting to work in diversity work and inclusion work, further on down the road. And then I moved to Mankato, Minnesota, and served as the Director of African American Affairs at Minnesota State University, Mankato. And so I was there for a while, and I saw this position at UWS, and I've been looking for more of a challenge to. So when I saw what the job was, which was overseeing the different centers, the Office of Multicultural Affairs, Gender Equity Resource Center, the Veterans and Non-Traditional Center, as well as the First Nations Center, but also looking at the campus overall from a campus climate standpoint and diversity initiatives, I just saw it as a really good opportunity to kind of challenge myself and to have an impact on a campus. So the position was felt like it was written for me. So
very cool.
And it kind of spoke to me. So I was like, I was hesitant at first. I was like, it's kind of up there. It was like we were planning to go south after a few years of being in the north, but And we came up here, and the area was just so nice. We spent a few days in the Twin Ports area and kind of fell in love with the
wonderful
the scenes, the people, the community has been good since I've been here. So, yeah. It's been
so exciting. You're having a great time while you're here. And so do you have a family, if I may ask that?
Yes. My wife, her name is Gabrielle Benton, and I have two little girls, Aiden and Alyssa. They are 3 and 4, and they have birthdays coming up. So they're 11 months apart.
Oh, wow.
So for 1 week, they're going to be the same age.
Uh-huh.
So after Saturday, they both will be 4 for 8 days. And then my oldest will turn 5 on the 12th.
So. Oh, that is very cool. So I can only imagine that having young kids in the household, how much joy that is.
Yes, it's a lot of joy.
Yeah.
And full of excitement and unexpected situations.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So let me ask you if you could talk a bit about what your primary functions are in the job that you have as the Diversity and Inclusion Director.
Yeah, so as I mentioned, part of my job is overseeing the centers and kind of setting direction for the centers as far as, you know, how we're going to serve students from a student services perspective. Also, as far as campus climate and campus diversity and looking at that from a high level, you know, what can we as an institution do? What strategies can we put in place to be a welcoming and welcoming and inclusive environment on campus? So looking at it from that perspective, and then also affirmative action on campus as well.
Okay, so you do affirmative action. Mm-hmm. So let me ask you this then. So your role is to make sure that if a student or even a faculty person had perceived issues of diversity related, for example, they've experienced discrimination of some mm-hmm. sort, they would go to you.
Absolutely.
As the first step.
As the first step through filing a complaint through the Equity and Diversity and Inclusion Office. And from that point, we conduct investigations from there.
So what does that look like? So you say there's a process. They file a complaint, fill out a form or what have you. Mm-hmm. And so once that form is filed, what kind of process is it? I'm just
so
curious.
So give you the process as it is now, but this is one of the things that we are actually – I've been having some meetings today on that, on how we reshape that and how we get other individuals on campus trained. So as it stands today, they will file a complaint and then they will submit any documentation that they may have to kind of support their case. And then from that point on, either myself or working with the Human Resources Office will conduct an investigation, have conversations with both the individual that reports the incident and then also those that may be accused of discrimination in any form, and just kind of get both sides of the story. And sometimes it might not be direct discrimination. It could be personality clashes, mm-hmm. Some other things. So when those type of things occur, how do we kind of remediate those, and what type of conversations and expectations do we put in place to mm-hmm. kind of try to resolve those issues? If there are some discrimination acts there, then from that point on, working with the supervisor and the Human Resources Office is kind of figure out what is the best action. One of the things that I wholeheartedly believe in is educating people, right? We are an educational institution.
Absolutely,
so,
right.
Even from a student perspective to a faculty staff perspective, you know, I firmly believe that should be a part of that process is working with those individuals and educating them.
Mm-hmm.
And whether it's on implicit bias, microaggressions, whatever the case may be. So my hope in the future is to have investigators on campus, not just myself, but other parties that can conduct investigations and then also include some educational components to it as well. So we can, you know, it's not always about bringing down the hammer on someone,
right?
But more or less about, you know, how can we help this individual gain some perspective of their actions. So.
Well, you know, I found the University of Wisconsin Superior campus to be quite good mm-hmm. at treating people fairly and mm-hmm. with respect and dignity. So I'm glad you're in this role. I think you're the perfect person for it. Just by virtue of your ability to interact with people and, and investigate whatever needs to be investigated, you're going to be fair.
Absolutely.
And that's what people expect, but that's a trait that I'd like to see personally from more people.
Absolutely.
Be fair
Absolutely.
About the process.
Yeah.
You know, yep. And so thank you for that. So I know you're very important on campus, and I know you're a member of the Chancellor's Cabinet, mm-hmm. and so having said that, your role, in my opinion, is not just a role for the campus. I think you have the ability to go outside of the campus.
Absolutely.
And what does that look like? You're busy here on campus, but what's your role outside of the campus?
Yeah, I think that we do play an important role on the campus. We are a regional institution, so mm-hmm. that is part of our mission and the way that we conduct business. So right now we're kind of going through a strategic planning process, and one of the goals that we're looking at is cultural engagement and cultural competency, not only of just the campus, but how can we engage the community in that aspect. And as we go through that, we're going through some SWOT analysis with different organizations on campus, and then and I've already had some conversations with like Nick Alexander, mm-hmm. the chief of police in Superior, and tried to be involved in the community and get my face out there so people kind of know that we're here. But in turn, what can we do from an institutional perspective to offer services that may be beneficial for the community? And that was one of the reasons when I came here, the big question was, are you going to live across the bridge in Duluth, or are you going to live in Superior? And I chose to live in Superior because I want to be immersed in the environment that my students and as well as other faculty and staff live in, so I can get the experience of the community that they're, constantly walking in and out. Campuses are like little cities themselves.
Absolutely.
But
yes.
once you leave your little city, what's that experience like? So I think community engagement is going to be, a big piece. But it's really going to take us, getting the community leaders together and kind of figure out what are the needs of the community and what ways can we partner to help support those needs.
So we're going to continue that part of the conversation. We're going to take a quick break. This is People of Color on Wisconsin Public Radio. We'll be right back. Welcome back to People of Color on Wisconsin Public Radio. This is Henry Banks. I know we were talking, Jarrell, before we went to break about your outreach in the greater community of Superior and the region. But I wanted to say that Nick Alexander, you mentioned Nick, is the police chief in Superior, and he has shown incredible leadership in a short period of time. And I just wanted to thank him for his leadership as the chief of police in Superior. So people need to understand that he is a very fine leader also.
Absolutely, absolutely. And, we've had that opportunity to kind of sit down and have lunch. And it was more of a personal conversation, but we did talk a little bit about the needs of the community. And, I offer ways that we can engage, whether through some form of training, us working with the police department here. But also, just from a institutional perspective, I've seen the commitment that Nick has made to the institution. He is heavily involved with our Black Student Union on campus. You would think he's a member of the organization as much as he's involved. So what we're going to have to do is really do an inventory of what the resources are in the community, both in Superior and Duluth, because, we do pull strong population from both areas. I've had the opportunity to meet, people like Carl Crawford with the Human Rights Commission in Duluth, engage a little bit with the NAACP. And so really just figuring out, what are their agenda? What's their agenda and their roles, and how can UWS kind of play a role in that?
So, mm-hmm. So in your opinion, I'd like to ask you to kind of comment on why do you believe in 2017 we still have a need for these kinds of offices? diversity and inclusion, human rights offices. We're in 2017.
Yep.
And it seems as though in this country we have gone backwards.
Uh-huh. And I think part of it from my experience is there used to be a stronger culture of civility. But, you know, the tides have kind of changed now. And I don't want to try to normalize any of this stuff mm-hmm. by any means. So those roles, I think, are important to help remind us and to educate us and bring us together to make sure that we, at the minimum, have a culture of civility.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
I think civility is technically something that should just be automatically given, right? You know, civility and respect kind of going hand in hand. But how do we move to a point of, you know, acceptance, mm-hmm. right? And I think those positions play a key role in that. If we can move from that place to where civility is not the norm to back to where, you know, it was, as you may have mentioned a little while ago, mm-hmm. to more, how do we start dealing with acceptance and training people in the different areas of diversity and become more competent and more comfortable with having those conversations and interacting with people? I always tell my students and other people that I encounter, it's not necessarily about stepping outside of your comfort zone. It's more or less about expanding your comfort zone, because you can step out of your comfort zone and go right back in. But if you expand it, that shows a sign of not only just respect, but more of a acceptance of differences. And I think that's the point that we need to get to.
So do you ever hope or believe there will not be a need for these offices? Or do you think we're still quite a ways away from that happening?
I think we're a little ways. And I think even if we ever get to that point, I think the scope of those offices can change to be more of a proactive type of position instead of more of a reactive mm-hmm. Position, to where we are really kind of banding together for human dignity.
Sure.
And figuring out for our communities, what can we do to make our communities strong? What can we do to make sure that the education system's strong, that, you know, all aspects of the Twin Ports area specifically, how can we make sure that we're strong in those areas? So I think the need for those positions would be there, mm-hmm. but I just think we can just change the scope to where we're you know, focusing on those things.
So I want to ask you, too, because, again, we are in a, I think, a quagmire in this country where immigration mm-hmm. Is a big issue, a big concern to some. Do you have a role on campus in working with the immigrant community of students and faculty, and how does that work with regard to folks who may be in fear? Mm-hmm. How does that work, and does that come under your office or?
Sure. I think it's more of a partnership. I think from the faculty and staff perspective, my office does have a key role into making sure that we are supporting our international faculty and staff in whatever ways that we can. But there's also, from the student side, a partnership with the Office of International Programs. So one of the cool things we did when initially the immigration ban came out, of course, we communicated with our students, and the Office of International Programs had direct communication with students that could possibly be affected, and gave them some tips, some pointers of kind of what their rights are and how to protect those rights. But also from a community standpoint, UWS did something very specific, and we just wanted to send a strong communication to not only just our students that are our international students that are already on campus, but also the prospective students, and did a really cool video of that says, that you are welcome here. Mm-hmm, and it was just a bunch of different students, faculty and staff that just continually communicated that message so people can know that they are welcome here. And that's what we're going to do to maintain that climate is, you know, we're going to continue to support our students in the best way that we know how and the best ways that we can. And give them those areas to kind of have those conversations and kind of share some of those frustrations. Give them space to have those conversations, for administration to listen, and then for also for us to provide some action. I think that's the key portion, is not only just communicating and listening, but it has to come with some action and strategizing what we do and how we support our students the best way.
Mm-hmm. So for my listeners, and I'm sure they're going to be asking this one question about you. Mm-hmm. So what does a typical day look like for you?
Oh, man.
In that office?
It literally varies from day to day. One of the things that I always try to include in my day is to stop in at one of the centers, at least one, if not more, because I really long for that student interaction, mm-hmm. but also the interaction with the staff in those areas. But at this point in the early stages, it's spent in a lot of meetings because we are starting a strategic planning process where we're looking at diversity and inclusion from a campus-wide standpoint. So that means everyone's going to kind of have a stake in it. Mm-hmm. And so right now we're just kind of communicating a lot of those goals that we're setting and really starting to move towards the point to where we're talking about strategy and action. So our goal is to roll out this strategic plan in the fall semester. Okay. It'll be surrounded by a lot of educational pieces, but also strategies from the different units on campus to make sure that we're creating a welcoming environment.
Mm-hmm. I want to ask you this as well. If we as a society are to heal or are to continue to heal from racism, mm-hmm. and other isms that keep us separate, what do you believe we must do, or what we need to continue doing to make our society a society for all?
And this might sound a little touchy-feely, but at times I can be that way. Number one is it all starts with the conversation. Being willing to have a conversation, being open to listening, and then I think it really takes for us, and this is my rhetoric that I stole from a colleague of mine, Daryl Pravat, back at Morehead State, but it really takes for us to step outside of our six blocks. Meaning, usually our circle of friends are within our six blocks. They have the same type of thinking, the same type of background, same type of political affiliation, mm-hmm. Same, you might be in the same religion, all these things are usually the same, but just take some time to really engage in a totally different environment and immerse yourself, not just step in, but immerse yourself, whether it's committing to mentoring someone that might not be in the same social class as you or participating in some of the organizations. I don't know if there's a Big Brothers, Big Sisters program, Boys and Girls Clubs, things of that nature to start to get a different perspective, to wear a different lens. And then I think from that, you start to develop empathy, mm-hmm. Not necessarily sympathy, mm-hmm. where you just feel sorry for someone. Because
right.
I think that could be easily done by seeing a story on the news. But really understand someone's feelings and kind of take those up on yourself. Mm-hmm. And if we can get to that point, and I'll add this too, everyone has a story. So start sharing your story as well,
mm-hmm.
Because my story is totally different than Henry's story.
Yes.
Even though we have the same, we're of the same sex and mm-hmm. we are of the same color,
yep.
we're two totally different people. And
that's
I
right.
think people can benefit from hearing each other's stories. So mm-hmm. I say that's at least the starting point where we need to be at to really kind of move that along.
Mm-hmm. So you brought a lot of experience to the UWS campus relating to diversity and inclusion. So you are being that catalyst for change.
Mm-hmm.
That's a lot to have on your shoulders. I understand that. So having said that, every time you open your office door, How do you do this day in and day out and still keep a positive attitude about your work?
That was a really good question, Henry. For me, I think where my passion comes from has to come from my upbringing. So I bring a lot of that. I say everybody has a suitcase.
Mm-hmm.
As you can tell, I talk a lot in metaphors. Everybody has a suitcase. So I bring a lot of things that are in my suitcase from my past that I think helped shape who I am today. So part of that is I have to be very resilient.
Mm-hmm.
And knowing that sometimes it's going to seem like I've been knocked down, but
yes,
you got to get back up and continue the fight. And part of it for me is just being open and understanding of that we live in a society where there are some people that just don't know, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it takes a lot of patience. It takes a lot of compassion. And I think those are two characteristics that I try to embody that helps me get through, you know, those tough times. And then, of course, when things are going great, you know, we're just going to ride that.
You're just going to ride it, right?
It takes a lot of compassion, takes some empathy, and just constant reflection of what's in my suitcase to kind of keep me on track.
Mm-hmm. Anything else you want to share with our listeners?
No, I'm excited about what we're doing at UWS, and I'm hoping that the Twin Ports can surround it. Some of the goals that we're focusing on is communication. How do we communicate, you know, the excitement around diversity on our campus? Because I believe even before I got here, the institution was doing some really good things. But how do we broadcast that, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then the other goals include assessment implementation. We always need to know what's working well and what's not. And then also doing a routine campus climate survey. How do we recruit faculty and staff of diverse backgrounds as well as students? And expanding that definition of diversity as well, not necessarily talking about people of color or native
mm-hmm.
Individuals, but people that just come with different life stories, different experiences that are willing to share that. And then also, how do we engage the campus from a cultural engagement standpoint to really make sure that our students leave our institution prepared to be able to interact within a global society. So we're excited about it, and hopefully, you know, the community will be able to surround us, and we'll continue to kind of communicate through your show.
I hope so.
Hopefully, and sharing some of the good things that are happening.
Thank you. Jarrell Benton is Director of Diversity and Inclusion and the Affirmative Action Officer at the University of Wisconsin in Superior. Thank you for being on the show today.
Thank you.
We'll be right back.
First, I would like to say that I'm speaking not for myself, but as a follower and helper and representative of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, who is the spiritual head of the fastest growing group, religious group, of black people here in the Western Hemisphere. When we give our views, we don't give them as a civic group, we don't give them as a political group, but we give them primarily as a religious group. And any solution that we support, we absolutely feel that it's a religious solution rather than a political solution. One of the reasons that the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, in teaching us here in America, is giving us a solution that differs drastically from the sit-in movement, he's trying to make us men. Now, the very fact that you find students all over the world today are standing up for their rights and fighting for their rights, but here in America, the so-called Negro students have allowed themselves to be maneuvered under a tag of sit-in. It actually, I guess it describes it, the name describes its nature. It's a passive thing. And if their goal is integration, it's not a worthwhile one. But if their goal is freedom, justice, and equality, then that's a worthwhile goal. If integration is going to give the black people in America complete freedom, complete justice, and complete equality, then it's a worthwhile goal. The holding this integration bottle, dangling it in front of the Negroes in America today, has actually disabled them, or it has nullified their ability to stand up and fight like a man for something that is theirs by right, rather than to just sit around and beg and wait for the white man to make up his mind that they're worthy to have this type thing. I think that this is, in my opinion, why we disagree with the sit-in movement. If they are willing to wait for another 100 years for the white man to change his mind to accept them as a human being, then they're wrong. But if they're willing to lay down their life tonight or in the morning in order that we can have what is ours by right tonight or in the morning, then it's a good movement. But as long as they're willing to wait for the white man to make up his mind that they are qualified to be respected as human beings, then I'm afraid that all of their waiting and their planning is for naught. As Thurgood Marshall said on New Year's Eve, the Supreme Court brought about the desegregation decision, I think, 6 or 7 years ago, and there is only 6% desegregation in America right now. We don't call two students, black students, going to the University of Georgia integration, nor do we call four children, black children, going to school in New Orleans integration, nor do we call a handful of black students going to school in Little Rock integration. If every black man in the state of Arkansas can't go to any school he wants, that's not integration. And if every black child in the state of Louisiana cannot go to any school that they are qualified for in the morning, then that's not integration. And likewise with Georgia and any other state in America. It's no integration with us until the entire thing is laid on the table, not 100 years from now, but in the morning. And at the rate that the NAACP, CORE, and the Urban League is willing to accept the change of attitude in the white man's mind, we who are Muslims feel we'll be sitting around here in America for another 1,000 years, not waiting for civil rights or something like that, but even waiting to be granted the rights of a human being.
I have a feeling that a great many words have been floating around this table, which need to be redefined. And that, by the way, is the problem I think which is facing this entire country. Now, I don't agree with Mr. X about the sit-in movement, and I do know something about the war, the incipient war between the students and some of the leaders. I know the gap, the enormous gap between the NAACP and the children in the South. I don't agree that the sit-in, you know, I don't agree that it is necessarily passive. I think it demands a tremendous amount of power in one's personal life and in terms of political and polemical activity. Sometimes to sit down and do nothing, or seem to do nothing. But finally, when the sit-in movement started, or when a great many things started in the Western world, it was not. I think it had a great deal less to do with equality than it had to do with power. And I do think we have to decide what we want. You know, now what has happened in the world in relation to black people is not that white people have suddenly changed or become more. More conscious of a black man's humanity. What has happened is very simple. This is the white power has been broken, and this means, among other things, that it is no longer possible for an Englishman to describe an African and make the African believe it. It is no longer possible for a white man in this country to tell a Negro who he is and make the Negro believe this. The controlling image is absolutely gone. Now, it seems to me the responsibility which faces us then, the question which faces us, which faces me in any case, is since there is a distinction between power and equality, there is a distinction between power and freedom, and I know that in terms, for example, of Africa, that an African nation cannot expect to be respected unless it is free. I know that unless it has its political destiny in its own hands, which is what we mean by power, there is no hope that the English will deal with an African nation as a subjugated nation as long as it is in fact subjugated. That is not quite the same situation that we face here in America as American Negroes. I can see that I might very well, for one reason or another, leave this country tomorrow and never come back. But this will not make me, I will not cease to be an American Negro for this reason. And the history of our history in this country is something that I think we have to face, especially since we're demanding that white people face it. And whether I like it or not, whether you like it or not, this issue about integration is a false issue, because we have been integrated here ever since we got here. I am no longer a pure African. There are no pure Africans in this country. The history which has produced us is something which, in any case, we're going to have to deal with one of these days. Now, I think it is a mistake to pretend this history did not happen. What we're arguing about, I think, one of the things, in any case, I think I would be arguing about, is the effect of this on the Negro world and the great divisions in it, so that it does, in fact, range from people who imagine they are white, you know, who never talk to Negroes, to people who imagine that if they can make a buck, they will somehow beat the system, to homeless and demoralized black boys and girls who have nowhere to, who don't know where to go. The issue, it seems to me, the reason that the civil movement is important, the reason this whole ferment is of such importance, is not that I want anybody's cup of coffee, or even to go, particularly to anybody's school. It is because the country cannot afford to have, as it has at this moment, millions of black boys and girls in various ghettos all over the country, either perishing literally, or perishing, I must say, finally, with the kind of demoralization and bitterness and hatred, which can, after all, blow this country wide apart. The importance, in my mind, of the Muslim movement, in conclusion, is that it is the first time, I think, in the history of this country, that a Negro audience, a Negro laborer, a Negro schoolboy, has heard his own condition described without anybody trying to flinch from it. It is very different hearing speech by Roy Wilkins, in which, you know, one is told, in one way or another, that tomorrow will be better. And I think this has a tremendous effect. This is the reason the Muslim speaker has so much power over his audience. It comes out of a failure in the Republic. This country has lied about the Negro situation for 100 years. And now what has happened is the lies are no longer viable, can no longer be accepted even when they make it told. And the country has waited so long that it does not know how to handle this and has created a moral vacuum. There's a moral vacuum in the Negro ghettos in the same way there's a moral vacuum in New Orleans, which is filled with desperate people. Now, I don't think that we can afford this. It seems to me, and now I speak for myself, my quarrel with the official Negro leadership, and my quarrel with those such Negroes as imagine they are integrated or imagine they somehow escaped the Negro condition, is that they are not willing to do what I think is absolutely essential. One has got to re-examine the basis, the standards of this country, which not only afflict black people, they afflict the entire country. No one in this country, as far as I can see, really knows any longer what it means to be an American. He does not know what he means by freedom. He does not know what he means by equality. We live in the most abysmal ignorance of not only the condition of 20 million Negroes in our midst, but the whole nature of the life being lived in the rest of the world. And I think that the American white man, the Republic, is beginning to pay for his treatment of the Negro in terms of what he does not know about the rest of the world. You cannot live, it seems to me, you cannot live 30 years, let's say, with something in your closet which you know is there and pretend it is not there without something terrible happening to you. By and by, I cannot say, if I know that any one of you, has murdered your brother, your mother, and the corpse is in this room under the table, and I know it, and you know it, and you know I know it, and we cannot talk about it. It takes no time at all before we cannot talk about anything, before absolute silence descends, and that kind of silence is descending on this country. I think that this country has become almost inconceivably radical. It has really got to do something that's not done before, and this involves the humanity of everybody in it. And the key to this is in the Negro. If one can face that, one can face anything. But that has not been faced. And I think this is the reason for the confusion and the ferment and the great, great danger. Again, let me say this, and I will stop. I'm not religious. And therefore, since I'm not religious, all theologies, for me, are suspect. All theologies have a certain use. But I never, for example, believed in the myth of the virgin birth. I never quite understood why it was necessary to propagate such a peculiar notion. Therefore, you know, as theologies go, it seems to me the Muslim theology is just as good as any. We're going to quarrel with it there. I can't, anyway. But I personally reject that theology as I reject all others. And I don't think that we need it. Now, this is a gamble. It's a very reckless thing to say. And perhaps, you know, perhaps it's very mystical. I know the kind of world I would like to see. I would like to think of myself as not needing to be supported by a myth. I would like to see myself as being able to face whatever it is I have to face as me, dealing with what I have and what there is, without having my identity dependent on something which finally has to be believed, which cannot be tested. This is why one is converted to a religion, you know. I think that there's something very dangerous in it. What I would like to see, and maybe we'll never live to see it, is a world in which these things are not necessary, which I will not need to invent, in effect, a heritage and a history, but I can deal with the one I have, and will not need, in order to deal with the rest of the world, will not need to feel superior to them, but simply be a part of them. And it seems to me this may happen. Well, I love to see a world in which there are no blacks, there are no whites, where it does not matter. Because as long as it does matter, and it doesn't matter who is wearing the shoe, the confusion will be great and the bloodshed will be great.
Well, I, as a black man, and proud of being a black man, I can't conceive of myself as having any desire whatsoever to lose my identity. I wouldn't want to live in a world where none of my kind existed. I do think that the Negro, American so-called Negro, is the only person on earth who would be willing to lose his identity in a what you might call a new product. I heard one fellow say one day that there eventually intermarriage and intermixing would take place on such a vast scale that it would produce a chocolate-colored race. And Martin Luther King was in a televised discussion, with a white newspaper man. I saw it on the television a couple months ago. And this white newspaper man put this to him. He pointed out that he's proud of his white race. He's proud of what he is. He's proud of his racial characteristics to the extent where he has no desire to lose it by mixing with any other race. And the thing that he said he couldn't understand was why the so-called Negroes don't have the same racial pride that whites have in trying to retain their characteristics. And Martin Luther King never answered him, although he should have answered him. I think that it is disastrous for the black people in America to reach the point where their racial pride disappears, and they don't care whether their blood is mixed up with someone else's. I think that also one of the things that brings this about, as the Honorable Elijah Muhammad teaches us, the very fact that you have to refer to the black man in America as a Negro shows you that right there something is wrong. An African doesn't accept this term Negro, and you find they teach us in the educational system of this country that Negro is a Spanish word that's supposed to mean black. Yet when you find the black people who live in Spanish-speaking countries of South and Central America, they don't accept the word Negro to identify themselves. No one allows himself to be classified under the word Negro but the black man here in America who is a descendant of the slaves. And very seldom is it ever applied to anybody but the black man here in America who is the descendant of the slaves. When you ask a man his identity, he should use a word that connects him with a culture. If you ask him his nationality, it should connect him with a nation. Like if I ask a man his nationality and he says German, that connects him with Germany. Or if he says, even if he says German-American, it still connects him with having originated. His family, his history has originated in Germany. If he says he's French-American, it connects him with France. But when you ask the black man in America, and he tells you Negro, he doesn't put any other country in front. He puts American Negro, or he'll just say Negro. This doesn't identify him. And usually, when you find a man who calls himself a Negro, he can't tell you what language that he spoke before he came to this country. It's of no consequence, no interest. He believes that prior to coming here, he was a savage in the jungle, and therefore he had no language, and this justifies his lack of knowledge concerning that mother tongue today. and the history, as Mr. Baldwin pointed out, of the white man here in America and the black man here in America, points up the fact that the Negro, or the man here who calls himself a Negro, is just an ex-slave. If he is an ex-slave, I'd rather say he's still a slave. But he's wearing his slave master's name, the name that was given to him during slavery. He's speaking the language of the man who made him a slave because he has no knowledge of his own tongue. He only knows the history, his own history, as taught to him by his former slave master, who purposely hid from him his own history to make him think that he was an inferior being before being brought here. And Mr. Muhammad teaches us that until the black man here in America is connected or reestablished or given some knowledge of his existence prior to coming here to America, his own appraisal of himself will be so low that he'll actually think that the white man is doing him a favor to let him be here in America no matter what his status is. And he also, and this is one of the reasons today why he fights so hard, some of them, to sit down next to the white man. They actually think that the white man is the personification of perfection, and whenever they're allowed to go live in his neighborhood or sit in his restaurant or mingle or socialize with him, that they have attained, that they have made progress. But when they go back and study the history of their own people and the accomplishments of their own people, the civilizations and cultures, black civilizations and black cultures that existed in Africa at a time when the whites in Europe were living a cave-like existence, then immediately their appraisal of their self, of themselves begins to go higher. And they don't think that to beg somebody to mingle with them in this country is any kind of progress whatsoever. And I would like to say one more thing, too, on that nonviolent thing, that the black man in America is the only one who is encouraged to be nonviolent, or the black man in Africa, or the black man in Asia. Never do you find white people encouraging other whites to be nonviolent. Whites idolize fighters. They idolize the Hungarian freedom fighters who came to this country and right now can work on jobs that the sit-in students can't get, can live in neighborhoods that the sit-in students can't live in, and can go into public places that the student sit-ins can't go, because they are fighters. Everyone loves a fighter. They respect the fighter. But at the same time that they admire these fighters, they encourage the so-called Negro in America to get his desires fulfilled with a sit-in stroke or a passive approach or a love-your-enemy approach or pray for those who despitefully use you. This is insane. And we feel as Muslims, until we see white people practicing this nonviolence, take Pearl Harbor. When the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor, the American white man didn't say, pray for the Japanese and let them now bomb Manhattan or Staten Island. No, they said, praise the Lord, but pass the ammunition. And if anybody comes along like Mr. Muhammad and begins to point out uncompromisingly in blunt terms that don't need diplomatic language that can be misinterpreted, and he begins to point out these atrocities and crimes that have been committed against black people here in America today, the white man can never deny the fact that he's guilty, but he'll always say, well, forget the past and let's look forward. But the only people who are told to forget the injustices that have been done to them are the black people. But when it comes to whites, right today, you can turn on any radio, turn on any television, read any newspaper, and the Jews have magnified to the world the crimes that were committed against them 20 years ago or so by Eichmann, and they keep you sitting on the edge of your seat wanting to strangle Eichmann. It's almost like a Hate Germany campaign, but yet the Jews are never accused of teaching hate because they remind the world of the crimes that were committed against them. But when the black man here in America begins to stand up and speak about the crimes that are committed against him throughout America every day, no let up, just different forms, immediately a black man who dwells on that is considered a racist, considered an extremist, or considered someone who is advocating a doctrine that'll bring about violence and bring about a deterioration in the so-called good relations that are supposed to be developing between black and white in this country. So we just can't go along with any of that. And I think that this is the thing that the white people of America should realize, that Mr. Muhammad's teaching
and it's spreading, so you have to deal with it. Mr. Muhammad's teaching doesn't teach the black man to wait for the white man to change his mind. Mr. Muhammad's teaching is changing the black man's appraisal of himself. And as soon as the black man undergoes a reappraisal of himself and realizes that he's a man too, he says to himself, why should he wait for the Supreme Court to give him what a white man has when he's born? Why should he wait for the Congress or the Senate or the President to tell him that he should have this, when if he's a man the same as that man is a man, he doesn't need any President, he doesn't need any Congress, he doesn't need any Supreme Court, he doesn't need anybody but himself to bring about that which is his, if he is a man?
I think in the first place there's some disagreement between Mr. Malcolm X and myself as to what this heritage is. And I want to go back to that in a minute. Something else at the moment bothers me. I think there's a great deal, there's not much clarity in this question of violence. From my point of view, from where I sit, whether or not, no matter what Mr. X wants, no matter what I want, I believe, for example, that one of these days, maybe tomorrow, Birmingham, Alabama will probably blow up. And if Birmingham blows up, it will not just stretch to Atlanta, it will stretch to Boston. There's a kind of fuse. There's a kind of there's an undercurrent. There's something which unites all the Negroes in this country, so that what happens in Birmingham can blow up Harlem. It has happened before. And unless we are extremely swift and miraculously swift, it will happen again. I take it as given. I think it is coming in any case. What exercises my mind is what happens then. In the first place, this country, in this position in the world now, this extremely precarious position in the world now, the situation of the Negro here is different from that of the Jews in Germany, let's say, 20 or 30 years ago. In that, if Birmingham should blow up, if they should really erupt in America this week, real racial violence, it would have repercussions all over the world. I'm afraid we have to face this fact, that when the Jews were being slaughtered in Germany in the very beginning, no one seemed to care. Millions of Jews crossed the world, and boatloads of them, and no country would let them in. But the American Negro has something working for him in this context, or the country has something working against it, which I don't think he can afford. But I want to get back to this question of identity, because it seems to me this is where really where...